Welcome, everyone, to the All Out Coach podcast. My name is Tim Mikelashvili. I'm your host, also CEO and co-founder of Amadev Pharma, a performance analytics and organizational change agency for life sciences that uses a sports and science formula to help medical organizations describe their impact directly on the business, on the healthcare community, and patients as well. As you know, on this show at All Out Coach, we celebrate both sportsmanship and scientific thinking in order to help extend our boundaries of our roles or our responsibilities in life and also transcend the differences that we have among each other. Today, I'm absolutely excited about having a five-time Olympic champion, Gary Hall Jr., join us, patient advocate, health consultant. He's going to talk to us about his experiences as both a performer, as a champion, as a leader in health and health tech innovation, as a type 1 diabetes patient advocate, success story, and an inspiration to millions worldwide. A little bit about him. So he has won 10 Olympic medals in swimming, 5 gold medals, and he has utilized a lot of his experiences to become a board member in healthcare, a patient advocate, keynote speaker. He's delivered 80 keynote presentations internationally, including at the Vatican, where he hosted a Cellular Horizons conference on stem cell therapy. He's testified 3 times before the Senate subcommittees on healthcare-related issues. First ever recipient of the USA Swimming's Humanitarian Award as well. He continues to be on the board of the National Youth Sports Health and Safety Institute at Sanford Health, which is the largest rural healthcare center in the United States, where he's also on the board of the World Clinic there. And while competing, Gary also co-founded the Race Club with his father, which is an elite swimming academy that has created many Olympic champions. And also he operates Sea Monkey Swimming, which is a successful learn to swim school in West Los Angeles. He's originally from Phoenix, Arizona. And I'm so glad that he's here on the All Out Coach podcast. Gary, what an honor and a dream really to speak to you, because I remember those moments and your stance as you won the gold medals with 2 hands up and your smile. I remember you as a showman as well. Really glad to speak to you today and learn from you.
Thank you, Tim. Thanks for having me on. It's my pleasure and an honor.
You come from a family of champions, swimmers. I want to ask you about when you first learned to thrive in competition and celebrate being a competitor.
It was a lightning bolt moment. I was about 14 years old. And I was at a rinky-dink swim meet in Glendale, Arizona. It was a cold and rainy day. I did not want to be there. At the time, I was a terrible swimmer. And coach put me in a lot of different events, just like everybody else. And it was the 200 freestyle. And dove in, started swimming. And if he had stopped me after the first lap and asked me, are you giving it 100%? I would have said, yes. Yes, coach, I'm giving it 100%. But by the third lap, I saw a guy that was about a body length ahead of me across the pool, 5 lanes over. And something happened. Something hit me. Something changed in an instant. And I said to myself, I'm going to beat that guy. And if I had said that I was giving 100%, I then found the 110%, the proverbial 110%, an overdrive that I didn't know existed. And I started reeling him in, and it came down to a really close race, stroke for stroke. And I out-touched him by the smallest margin at the wall. And it was for 67th place. I mean, this was, nobody else was paying attention to this race except for the other kid and I. We were, you know, battling it out, and I got it. And that was the moment I understood what competition was, and that I loved it. And so It was always that. It was, for me, I didn't care what the times were, no matter how fast I got. It was always about the race.
Mm-hmm. And how did your personal approach to competition impact your performance and your talent over time as you became a better swimmer?
It's hard work. There's no getting around that. I you mentioned in the intro, I come from a swimming family. My father was competed and medaled in three Olympic Games, 1968. He won a silver medal, 1972. The Munich Games, he won a silver medal. And in Montreal, he won a bronze medal. He was the U.S. flag bearer for Team USA in the 1976 Olympic Games. Voted by the captains of each of the sports competing in the Olympic Games. The only other swimmer that's ever done that is Michael Phelps. And he was World Swimmer of the Year twice. He was a phenomenally talented swimmer, known for his work ethic. And from an early age to the end of my swimming career, I was always compared to him. I have junior, you know.
Yeah, large shoes to fill.
Yeah, he was senior. And I had to work for it. And he knew that when he put me in swimming. I'm one of six kids. We all swam, and he wanted us to learn how to work, and knew that swimming instilled those skills. And so that was it. It didn't matter what the times were. In order to get the success in the sport, I had to show up, at 5:30 be in the water at 5:30 a.m. Which meant waking up at 4:30 a.m. to ride my bike to swim practice through high school every day, every single day. And so there's no getting around that. I don't care how talented you are. I don't care if the apple falls far from the tree, whatever the expressions are on that.
Right.
And I always despised, really despised, he's just talented. His father was a successful swimmer. Because it really does come down to hard work.
Gary, so I read interviews about you in which a lot of people criticized you throughout the three times that you competed in the Olympics. In 1996, they said that you were immature, too young. In 2000, in Sydney Games in Australia, they said that you were unhealthy. You had type 1 diabetes. And in 2004 in Athens, by that time, they criticized you because you were too old. Yet you defied all those odds. Why do you think that you're able to be so resilient and beat those odds and become a champion?
Yeah, I think naturally am defiant. And Winston Churchill, I believe the quote is attributed to, so in defeat, defiance, right? And so that came naturally to me. I wanted to defy doubters. There was almost as much, more joy in defying doubters than being the best. That was a huge, huge part of it for me, a driving, motivating factor. And so, anybody that is successful has had plenty of setbacks. And, when I was too immature, I was criticized for being a lazy sprinter in 1996. But I mentioned 5:30 a.m. practices, I was swimming 20,000 meters a day. During heavy training, we were going over 30,000 meters a day, every single day, outside of school hours that I was attending. That is an incredible workload that nobody matches today. Nobody does that type of yardage anymore. So, first of all, the accusations and the reputation was never accurate, that I was lazy or immature. I enjoyed life and would enjoy messing around or cracking jokes along the way, getting through, in the trenches, getting through that workload that it had, the sport demands, and because of maybe the fact that I was irreverent in my approach, or that I just didn't appear to be taking this seriously, I was taking it very seriously. So there was never any truth to it, which brought even more joy in defying those critics that were saying things like that. NBC at the top of the list. In 2000, I was diagnosed with diabetes a year and a half out from those games. And yeah, the odds were against me. That part was true. I became the first person with type 1 diabetes to compete and medal in the Olympic Games. And when I was diagnosed, I had two doctors tell me that it was impossible to do. Those words, it's impossible. You need to give up this dream. You need to worry about maintaining kidney health and not having your legs amputated and going blind. That's sort of the message that I received after the diagnosis. And so that was defying this. And it was, you know, a lot of hard work to be resilient in a situation like that. Because I was not a doctor. I had no formal training. I didn't know what the difference was between type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes. I didn't know what diabetes was. There was no family history of it. So I wasn't in a position to say, no, you're wrong, this can be done. I just had to go out and figure out a way. And that way that I figured out is now being taught in medical school. And there are so many other people, I don't want to single-handedly take credit for any of this. There are so many other great role models and examples that created new boundaries of what is possible.
Yeah.
And reset the standards of what it was believed to be possible, and it just wasn't right. And so there was a lot of satisfaction in defining that, because along with this disease comes discrimination, where, you know, you've got coaches that have a kid on the team with type 1 diabetes, and they start hearing about low blood sugar episodes, passing out and coma and seizures and type of stuff, and they view it as a liability, and the kid politely gets benched, mm-hmm. sidelined, or, you know. And so overcoming that and breaking through in that way and inspiring kids is what they believe was possible for themselves. So much satisfaction. But again, in defiance of what was thought to be possible by the medical professionals at that time. And so that's that. You know, doubt was warranted in 2000. I'll let that one slide a little bit more than that immaturity thing from 1996. And then in 2004, I became the oldest person to win an individual gold medal at the Olympic Games in swimming. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I wasn't old. I was 29, almost 30.
Right.
And, you know, I felt like there was still more to give. I wasn't washed up at that point. So yeah, again, you know, kind of setting. And now, you know, a friend and teammate of mine, Anthony Irvin, he was, you know, 34, almost 35 when he won in Rio. So mm-hmm. these boundaries keep getting pushed, and there's so many great role models and people that defied the odds and pushed that boundary just a little bit further.
Thanks for taking us through those three Olympics. But, you know, you mentioned a little bit about other people also defying odds. Who were some of those people that inspired you throughout that, you know, journey, that transformation? You know, because many people, I think, don't know the fact that you actually were the first Olympic champion with type 1 diabetes amidst your celebration and your love of swimming, of the sport, which all of us saw, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, where did you find that inspiration?
Well, the download after diagnosis of understanding what diabetes right. was and what entailed proper control, it's so difficult to achieve, especially for extended periods of time. So you may have an easy day here or there in diabetes management, but even if you do everything right, there's going to be flare-ups and highs and lows that are a roller coaster ride that is just difficult at every level, psychologically and physically. Obtaining this deeper understanding of diabetes management, that this was an impossible task 20 years ago, prior to my diagnosis. That there, you know, to test blood sugar, people were peeing on a test strip and you were getting kind of a very inaccurate reading of what it was at that one moment, and you didn't know if it was rising or dropping. People were boiling syringes. you know, to inject insulin up until not that long ago, shockingly not that long ago. And so I understood that all of a sudden we had blood glucose meters, not a continuous blood glucose meter. What a game changer that was. I wish that I had had that at the time. But there were innovations happening in medical research that empowered me, that enabled me to be able to reevaluate what is possible in this world of diabetes and sport. And so I was curious, because I also had a hope for a cure for this disease too. Like, maybe we can figure this out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I immediately threw myself in to diabetes research,
mm-hmm.
meeting with people that had were dedicating their lives to their pursuit as much as I was dedicating my life to swimming.
Okay, even as an athlete, right? As an active athlete, you're talking about before you even became the patient health advocate, which we'll talk about later.
Before the success of the Olympic Games.
Wow.
Yeah, immediately. So 3 months, even before I had qualified for the Olympic Games, nobody knew if I could do it or not.
Right.
I went to my very first JDRF event in Washington, D.C. It was the very first Children's Congress where we congregated kids from all over the United States to meet with the representatives on right. Capitol Hill. I was part of that 3 months after my diagnosis, when I was under the assumption that my swimming career was over.
Right.
And so this is, you know, something that I started meeting at these events and stuff, the researchers, the scientists, the people that were dedicated to the companies that were making better drugs, better means to manage the disease. And this was inspiring to me. Obviously, I had so much to gain from it. Not because at the time I knew that I could go, if I utilized these things, I could get back and be the best swimmer in the world. No, I was just trying to, at that point, I was very interested because I didn't want to lose my vision. I didn't want to lose a lower limb. I don't want to lose certain
hair.
Yeah.
You're young.
Being able to connect with people that in the lab space and these startups and large pharmaceuticals as well, companies as well, that were as passionate about what they were doing as what I was doing and making, alleviating human suffering.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I never, ever, ever get preachy, but I was brought up in a family that valued how to meet a man for others. A man for others was the motto of my high school, an all-boy mm-hmm. Jesuit high school.
Right.
And so how to alleviate human suffering. This was not just a religious indoctrination.
Sure.
This was a family creed. Right. This yeah. is something that we this is our,
it's so honorable.
Yeah. This is what life is about. How do we alleviate human suffering? How do we make life easier for others? And so I took naturally to this cause and patient advocacy, even sure. though sometimes it pitted me against large pharmaceutical companies that were the hand that fed, you know, and making stance against rising drug prices. Mm-hmm. And access to health insurance. You know, that made me a popular character amongst, you know, a better lucrative
yeah.
opportunity, you know, like routes.
Yeah.
So, I think that was the commonality that I immediately connected with the people in research, was that their ultimate goal, many of them, because of a personal thing, because they had a family member that had suffered from this disease and they wanted to make it easier for people in the future. I found that admirable
yep.
and inspiring.
Yeah, I think your courage as a champion, as an athlete, had continued to be consistent throughout your becoming a patient and an active, passionate advocate as well through your story. Would it be fair to then say that based on your increased visibility into the innovations in the research, you were then able to go past those two physicians who had told you, look, you can't compete anymore, but you were then, you know, driven to believe in that research and then as a result continue to compete and win at the Sydney Olympics?
Yeah, absolutely. And I can narrow it down to one individual. There was a woman, Dr. Ann Peters. Mm-hmm. She was at UCLA at the time. She's now at USC. Mm-hmm. And if it had not been for her, I was a walking suicide. That I had written it off and given myself enough time until the complications start showing up. But that was my plan. And not going back to the Olympic Games. And if it had not been for her and connecting with her and the way that I connected with her, my father, third generation doctor, mm-hmm. And he was an eye surgeon. And so he saw retinopathy, the effects of diabetes and managed diabetes in the eye frequently. And knew how devastating the disease could be. And so through that network, my father had identified this woman out in California and went out and met with her. And she said, oh, all right, let's give it a try. Was her response rather than saying, no, this can't be done. It's impossible. It was like, well, it's never been done before. Let's give it a try. And so I cannot give her enough credit for my ability to kind of get back in and try. And that's how all great things are accomplished. You know, taking somebody and starts with trying.
Thanks for reminding us and, you know, pointing out that your father was a physician also. And so I think this is a good segue for me to ask you about my hypothesis that, you know, the sports and the scientist mindsets are the two most productive for any business, regardless of their past training or experience in either. Because you started to have more relationships, business relationships, you start to speak for many organizations as a board member. What do you think about that hypothesis that I have at All Out Coach at Amedea Pharma?
Yeah, so there's one common thread that unites all successful people in my experience. And when you win at the Olympic Games, you meet so many interesting people, mm-hmm. titans of industry and you know, all different sectors and entertainment and sport. And the one common thing that I found amongst all of them was an obsession with being better, not to be the best necessarily. Yeah. There's some that say, one day I'm going to be the best or something like that. Yeah. But it wasn't that. It was all of their obsession with improving themselves, self-improvement, a little bit every day, just these very minuscule improvements. But if we can do that every day. And so that's what I appreciated in the dedication of the scientists and doctors was this. Through this debate about healthcare, I've heard that the healthcare system is broken. It's not broken. It's not the best. It's not the worst. It's somewhere in between. Is it right? And how do we move the needle? How do we improve that healthcare system just a little bit? Because we don't go from broken to fixed and nothing in between. It's somewhere in between. So how do we improve it? And it's those incremental improvements that will save us and save the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. So I saw that in the successful doctors and scientists. I saw that in the great capitalists and successful business people. And that's certainly what I had that pushed me, that got me to the top. And the only way to stay at the top is to continue to improve, because once you're there, everybody else is for you.
Gary, I know that you know, you at one point you had mentioned that you were not healthy enough to receive health insurance even as a patient. I read that in that same interview. And so I want to kind of switch gears now more and talk a little bit more in detail about your experiences throughout that transition and your perspectives of scientists, some of the leading scientists in the world, many of whom can have incredible credentials and also some expectations, personal expectations, and even ego, right? In many individuals, which you see in among physicians, among researchers, right? Thought leaders. Now, what surprised you and challenged you when you became a patient advocate first in diabetes?
one of the biggest realizations was that after I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes and being part of the national team, I couldn't get health insurance.
Right.
This was 20 years, a little over 20 years ago. I was healthy enough to win an individual gold medal at the Olympic Games and be the fastest swimmer in the world. Undisputed. Nobody could argue that.
Yeah.
I was not healthy enough to purchase health insurance. And so this was an immediate eye-opener on well, this is not right. That's not right. Because it was a pre-existing condition. And so it wasn't until the Affordable Care Act that I was even able to get insurance. And it was always so much trouble. And so to be able to get it, I had, because if I was on the national team, then I had insurance. But the second, the standard to be on the national team and get the health insurance was you had to be top 2 fastest in the United States and top 5 in the world. And so meets are staggered. Australia might have their big meet 3 months before the U.S. has their big meet. And if you were bumped outside of the top 5 fastest times in the world that year, the day it happened, they would drop my insurance. It was the first thing that they would do. And we get a letter, not even knowing what the results were from the meet that was happening across the other side of the world. And so
I probably the more inspiration to probably perform even better in order
demented way.
Yeah, in a kind of a dark way, right?
It definitely was a consideration because I couldn't afford health insurance at the time. People think, one of the best athletes in the world that you make money, but I was living on $1,200 a month was my stipend from USA Swimming through all of the Olympics. And so, health insurance mattered for a person with type 1 diabetes.
Can I ask how disciplined were you as a patient in order to, avoid any complications, right? Keep everything under control. Were you as disciplined as an athlete, as a patient?
Yeah, obsessive.
You were?
Yeah. You have to. Especially with the tools that I had at the time, finger sticks, right? Drawing blood, putting it into a test strip. It cost $1 or $2 per strip at the time. And testing your blood sugar and getting an accurate reading and having to do that 20 times a day to be able to get the trends that a continuous glucose monitor does for you now. It was not easy. It was not easy. But I realized at the time, if it's this difficult for me, or if there's some celebrity status involved in accomplishment, and how difficult is it for a family where the mom's working 2 jobs, the dad's working 2 jobs, and the kids are, struggling to get by. There's no safety net to help people, especially at that time. And so that was hard. And again, one of the realizations where, there wasn't even a name patient advocate. We were looking to do what AIDS patients had done in terms of advocacy. And it's phenomenal. It's still, to this day, is the gold standard in terms of what patient advocacy, what can be accomplished with patient advocacy. And so, we were so far from that, the diabetes community. There were a few organizations that were just struggling to get by and, do fundraising that, help provide some supplies to unprivileged, uninsured kids and stuff like that. But there was a glaring need. A glaring need, and so it made it a lot easier for me to be able to get in and do that because I knew how much it took to manage the disease, how difficult that was.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that your experiences as an athlete, as a champion, had an important impact on the leading scientists in whose hands and in whose control it was to make care more accessible for other patients, let's say? Did they get inspiration from you as an athlete to move this along a little bit faster, for example?
I don't have enough ego to think that I had anything to do that I inspired them to do their job better. To be honest, winning gold medals at the Olympic Games for me was a really humbling experience. So, you know, I think that this was the direction that they were headed in, that, you know, with or without me, that they would have been pursuing. Mm-hmm. And I applaud their efforts. I often describe myself through those years, half jokingly, as a cheerleader in medical innovation.
Right.
Because, like I said, when I first started doing it, I didn't know that catchphrase, patient advocate.
Right. But you're a passionate advocate as well. So the passion,
I think,
you need to spread the message, right?
And any chance I've had to meet with the brilliant minds at the bench, I, you know, certainly did my best to convey, one, appreciation. Appreciation, because they don't connect with patients very often. They're isolated, encapsulated in their lab space.
In the lab.
The patients that are living with this disease every single day, and they don't see the suffering in the same ways that the mothers and the fathers and the siblings do of people living with this disease. And so thanking them was very important for me. On behalf of all people with diabetes, really, thank you for what you're doing. This means a lot to us. And two, obviously saying, what you're doing is really important. Hurry up. Not so much hurry up, but, you know, what you're doing is really important. And, you know, I don't know if there was some motivation or encouragement in that.
So it's obvious that you've also learned a lot from the leading scientists throughout the 25 years or more that you've been a patient advocate. You alluded a little bit to some of those very sensitive issues of drug prices and issues on which you've very stood very firmly as a patient, as an advocate, as a citizen, as a United States citizen. What did you observe over the last few years in making those decisions that are more universal, that can make improving healthcare quality more accessible to other patients? Was there a particular trend that you observed as a patient advocate dealing with very different stakeholders? Is there improvement that you're seeing? What are some of the challenges still?
One of the first things you have to be prepared for when you make a stand is that you're going to be hated for it. That comes with a cost, a very steep cost of making a stand. For doing what's right comes at a tremendous cost. And so speaking up against outrageous price hikes in tandem, three different companies that produce insulin across the world for decades, lockstep. Speaking out against it, they sponsor everything. They sponsored me. This was the hand that fed that I referred to earlier. Making a stand against that, saying, hey, this is not right. This is a drug that's been around for 100 years. No altered formula or anything like that. All the tricks, how they are able to prolong the patents. It was wrong. It was wrong. There was a lot of bad things happening, and there were good people in the mix with these companies. This isn't blanket criticism against all people that were in that space, but that was really, really hard, and it came with consequences, speaking out against that. And I was not popular for a period of time amongst many, but I felt in my heart that this was what was needed. That somebody needed to be speaking out against this.
Sure.
That people were dying. That exploiting the sick is wrong. Morally wrong. And that it needed to be reeled in.
Yeah.
Controlled, regulated in some way. And so that was difficult. And so you're going to come, no matter who you are, where you're coming from, you're going to come across an opportunity to do the right thing that is not the easy thing.
Yeah.
And just know that it comes with consequences, but I think in time, you know, one day, we can look back and be a subset section saying, yeah, I was right. I was on the good side of the fight on that one.
As you know, I'm a healthcare professional, pharmacology background, medical education. I've spent 18 years in the pharma industry. But one of the reasons why I got into the industry was to bring safer products, you know, to patients. And I remembered drugs that were recalled after they came onto the market, which to me was unacceptable. You know, and in all the work that I'm doing, you know, I share the sentiment with many other healthcare professionals I know in the industry who want to directly improve patient outcomes. Right. Unfortunately, there's so many complex issues other than just the innovative qualities or attributes of a product that have to do with geopolitical issues or other stakeholders, health plans that may take those medical decisions out of the hands of those who need to, you know, really make those decisions, like physicians. Lately I'm certainly moved by patient advocates such as you and movement within the industry to allow patients to take health within their own hands and to connect also the health of our environment to to us as well, because the health of our world, of our, you know, of our universe ultimately impacts our own individual health. And those people who work in the industry, I think, are also not only healthcare professionals, but they're patients also. Their family members are patients. And sometimes they forget that, including those who I think make, you know, create the policies and have those decisions in their control. So I think your comments there are just so incredibly important and critical, because they provide balance. They inspire those who work in the industry to think a little bit more, to be a little more introspective, you know, Gary. And that's what I think you're reminding all of us.
Yeah, thank you for pointing that out. You mentioned in the intro, I proudly sit on a board of Sanford Health Research Herbal mm-hmm. Clinics. Mm-hmm. And my getting there, most people make it onto a board through incredible accomplishment or huge contribution, financial contribution. I didn't do any of that. So the reason why I was placed on the board at Sanford Health Research and World Clinic was because of patient advocacy work. It was patient advocacy. And so what I brought, my expectations for that board, was keeping in mind the patient perspective. And how wonderful this would be, an outstanding starting point. We talk about diversifying boards. How about putting some patient on a board? You never hear about that. And so Sanford Health has been exceptional in all my travels and all the companies that I've come across, and that they have the patient voice represented in the executive suite. And that's fantastic and shockingly rare. I worked with two of the three largest insulin companies and met hundreds and hundreds of staff from each of them. I only met one amongst the two that wasn't a drug rep that had type 1 diabetes. These are the largest insulin companies in the world. And he was near the C-suite, but he wasn't on the board or trustees or anything like that. Yep. I only met one person out of hundreds and hundreds of employees in the largest insulin companies in the world that had diabetes. And that was sad to me. That was really upsetting to me, that because the patient should be part of the conversation in healthcare. Yep. And that just has not been the case, not often enough.
What are some of the innovations in type 1 diabetes research that you're most excited about now that, you know, listeners, patients should know about?
I wrote my first letter, handwritten letter, to a congressman in 1999 about stem cell research, and have been following closely and advocating on behalf of it closely ever since. And there were so many challenges through the years on so many different fronts in that effort. But there's a company right now, iTolerance out of Miami, that is creating a large supply, an infinite supply of beta cells. and figuring out how to encapsulate them in a way that we can implant them and there's no autoimmune rejection issues. Mm-hmm. And so for me, this is what I'm most excited about in diabetes research at the moment. Mm-hmm. I would like to stop for a moment and applaud that all those that were involved in the continuous glucose monitoring device. That was the biggest game changer in diabetes innovation in the history of the drug since the isolation of insulin back in 1923. And so there continues to be devices that make our life easier, being able to connect and pair with insulin pumps, which I was never too keen on, or smartwatches and stuff like that. It's the CGM space that has been, you know, the biggest game changer. So I just, I love that. I'm not paid by anyone to endorse Dexcom or Abbott. Those are the two companies that really have great products out on the market. But they're, so those two things, what Dr. Lawrence out of Miami is doing. And
what's that company out of Miami, just so that everyone hears?
Yeah, iTolerance, letter I with tolerance after right. it. And that's Dr. Camillo Ricordi, and a few others. I knew him for years down in Miami. He was at the University of Miami for a long, long time. And doing beta cell transplants. But, you know, the problem was the, you know, rejection stuff. Mm-hmm. And the rejection drugs were the complications of that, taking that over an extended period of time, giving a six-year-old that has developed type 1 diabetes these rejection drugs, anti-rejection drugs, you know, were worse than properly managed diabetes. So, and there was such a finite supply of beta cells from cadavers. So through stem cell, we were able to address that, create a large enough supply to treat everyone. But how do we shut off the immune response or protect against the immune response? These guys have figured out how to do that and run in some trials in primate, non-human primates. And I'm really excited about what they do.
Great. And Gary, I do want to mention that you do a lot of work with patient engagement. And so you, I imagine, help patients connect to clinical trials as well. And you're an expert in this area, interest. Yeah. And there is probably needs to be something said about the importance of screening, right, and prevention as well. And I do have to recognize our mutual friend, Rob Adamowski, for introducing me to you at Prevention Bio, where I've also done some consulting work, which has a product that
delays
the onset of stage 3
type 1 diabetes
as well. So screening, any comments you have on the screening and the importance?
Yeah, so you mentioned Rob, what a great guy. And certainly prevention is on the right track and first to break through this barrier, right, and into a new space. And so what they've done and what's now being followed up, Sanford Health is involved in a pledge study, a screening program across, again, this is the largest rural healthcare system. So they're, you know, in 26 states currently. And the screening and prevention approach is a good one to take. Yeah. And something that I'm very aligned with through Sanford Health, and I've followed Rob and prevention.
Sure.
And everything they've done, they've led the charge.
Gary, the slogan at All Out Coach is stretch yourself, lift others. I want to ask you how you are currently creating new champions and passing the baton.
I'm very proud of what I accomplished in the sport of swimming. I'm very humble about what I accomplished in the sport of swimming, both. And I think that some of the training approaches that I was part of a very small group that we initiated has changed the way people train in swimming. And each, this is normal, each generation upon the shoulders of the last, right? And they keep building upon But I will take some credit that I was part of a very small group that changed dramatically. I mentioned in high school, I was swimming 20,000, 30,000 meters a day. That was the formula. Mm-hmm. And so the concept of sprint training, you were called lazy if you thought that was better. And I intuitively knew that it was better. And I looked at track and field. I remember as a sophomore in high school, on the pool deck, at 5:15, waiting to jump into the water, arguing with my coach, saying, in track and field, the 100-meter dash guys are not training the same as the cross-country guys. It's running. Yes, it's both running, but it's not the same. And it doesn't make sense that we're all doing the same. And, so we changed the way that swimming is trained for. I'm very proud of that. Through the race club, we do offer analysis and stuff to competitive swimmers. But it's something that I feel is much more giving back to the swimming community is the Learn to Swim program. And I'm not looking to create Olympic champions. I'm looking to instill love for this element of water. Mm-hmm. Something that connect. We are 90% water. Our cells are 90% water. We have this connection. And whether you believe we crawled from the sea many, 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 many years ago, or it's just in our cells. It is in our cells, in our DNA. We need water to live. And so I love water, not because I need it to live, but because I feel this spiritual connection to it almost. And being able to share that love and passion with a little kid, I'm talking 2 to 5 year old kids. Yeah. I get in the water with them. I don't have to do this as a career.
Sure.
But displacing fear mm-hmm. with confidence in kids is the most rewarding thing I've done, including winning gold medals at the Olympic Games. And because we do have a natural fear of water, the same way we recoil when we see a snake or a spider. It doesn't matter if it's a poisonous snake or we don't know. We still step back when we see a big spider or a snake. We have that same caution type of moment inherently, dating back from caveman days, the survival instincts, right? And so that fear of water is much stronger in some kids than in others, but being able to work with them, have them overcome that, and have that light bulb aha moment. It's like the first time you can ride a bike by yourself without the training wheels, and the eyes get this big, and they're just like, I can do it, I can do it. That is just a magical moment. And that's the other thing that I'm working on. And that's giving back to the sport.
Thank you, Gary, very much. I think you personify a winning formula between sports and science. I'm a huge fan of the Olympics since I was probably age of 9 or 10. And I associate championship and swimming with that smile and those two arms that you had raised, as winning. And I wish you to continue to pass on that winning philosophy with all of us. And I look forward to also to your keynote speech at the upcoming Medical Affairs Innovation Olympics on September 18th as well. Thank you, Gary, for sharing some lessons here today.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you. And looking forward to our next get together.
Yeah, absolutely.